And that's you, Mr. Kiyoka, is going to be beginning with 20 minutes and opening argument on the merits of the issue, and then the Right to Know Committee will be responding for 25 minutes. And Mr. Portnoy, will you be arguing, or Mr. Yip? Okay, Mr. Yip. And then the city and county appellants will be...
May it please the court, my name is Don Kitaoka. I'm a deputy corporation counsel for the city and county of Honolulu. I represent today the city council and its members. I'd like to start out by saying that this case was about city council reorganization, or an attempt at city council reorganization. The Sunshine Law claim regarding that reorganization was dismissed as moot. The circuit court, however, went one step further, and it went on to make an advisory ruling in a factual vacuum. It's our position, Your Honors, that case about the city council reorganization should have been dismissed in its entirety. Some background would be useful. The city council attempted to reorganize. The newspaper got hold of what the city council was planning to do in its reorganization and reported it in the newspaper. The OIP, Office of Information Practices, read the newspaper and realized that there must have been some understanding of what was going to happen at the city council reorganization, and therefore alerted the city council to the fact that the reorganization was taking place outside of a public meeting. However, after the OIP made that decision, the city council held its meeting, reorganized, and cured the problem as to the Sunshine Law by enacting a resolution which placed the issue of appointment of chairs to committees and committee members in the discretion of the city council chairman.
Council, given the city council's position on the interpretation of the statute, why isn't the whole question and issue, if we don't decide it here, why isn't it a situation that's capable of repetition yet evading review?
Well, for one thing, the whole case was about city council reorganization, one instance of a council reorganization. Therefore, when the city council took it out of the purview of the Sunshine Law, the city council put it in a position where this issue will never come up again.
If the council believes that the OIP's interpretation is erroneous, why wouldn't it ever come up again? And if it did come up again, how would the public know about it?
As far as the city council's interpretation, Your Honor, that is the problem that we perceive in this case. If whatever interpretation the city council takes, or whatever position the city council takes, is simply a position. With respect to council reorganization, the city council took it out of the realm of the Sunshine Law. That issue will never come up again. The whole issue that is being litigated as a remainder of this case is section 92-2.5 subsection A, which addresses two members of the city council having communications, when in fact the whole issue before the court originally was to be addressed under 92-2.5 subsection C, which addressed the selection of officers and committee chairs. So the whole issue regarding subsection A, which is the two-member permitted interaction, was never at issue. It was at issue because it was placed at issue by OIP. It was placed at issue by the plaintiffs. But in fact, if this case had gone to trial, it would have been about subsection C and whether the city council could engage in serial communications to reorganize.
What is the city council's position on whether it can engage in serial communications under the statute with respect to discussions of council business?
With respect to council reorganization, that would fall under...
In general, not limited to reorganization, just in terms of matters that are official council business, what is the council's position on whether, on the interpretation of 92-2.5?
Well, for one thing, It's unclear what the city council's position is when it's a conglomeration of nine members. That interpretation is not an official interpretation. City council never convened to make a position known. However, in the litigation down below, the city council did come out with nine individual declarations which set forth its position. The first position was that I have a firm belief in open meetings and intend to abide by the requirements of Hawaii Revised Statutes, Chapter 92, Part 1, the Sunshine Law. Number two, the city council, each council member said, I do not take the position that I can have unlimited serial one-on-one communications with other council members.
We've read the declaration. What was the purpose of that declaration? And purpose isn't that inconsistent with the position you're now taking, which is in your own brief, you say serial communications are okay?
Well, the position that the council took in the trial at the time of the litigation below was that they believe that serial one-on-one communications cannot be used to circumvent the Sunshine Law. And the purpose of that is to illustrate that there are circumstances in which serial one-on-one communications are permitted under the Sunshine Law, and that was explicitly and expressly recognized by the trial court, at least in two circumstances.
What I'm trying to get a handle on is what is the council's interpretation of that provision with respect to whether serial one-on-one communications are permitted? What is the council's position on that issue?
Well, there is no official council position. There are the position of the individual members, and the individual members set forth that position in its declarations. But with respect to the city council's argument as to the permissibility of serial one-on-one communications, they are permitted in certain circumstances.
What circumstances would those be?
Well, at least as to what the trial court said, one circumstance is when the city council's members want to call a special meeting or other matters that are procedural, or as the trial court said, purely procedural. These all meet the test of what is the definition of serial one-on-one communications. If, in fact, council members got together and decided, let's have a special meeting, each of those council members could visit each other.
What about substantive matters? Can they have one-on-one serial communications regarding substantive council business, not procedural?
They certainly could, Your Honor. And the court also recognized one specific example, like the budget bill. If, in fact, in a budget bill there are a multitude of line items, the budget bill is a matter of council business.
What is a bill with just one issue? Can they have serial one-on-one communication with respect to a proposed legislation that has one issue?
I would propose that they would have the ability to have serial one-on-one communications regarding any issue that is not deliberative or is not towards a decision. It's not decision making and it's not deliberation. For instance, if one council member went to a person that another council member that was introducing a bill, I would think that serial one-on-one communications could be one council member asking the introducer, what does this provision in the bill mean? I want to know that before I get to the meeting so I know what I'm voting on. So Council Member A would go to Council Member B and say, what does this provision mean? And after getting its answer, Council Member C wants to go to Council Member A and ask, what does this provision mean? Council Member A, under the interpretation of the plaintiffs, must say at that point, I can't talk to you. I can't talk to you at all. I already told Council Member B what I thought provision.
You agree with that? You think they should be able to?
Absolutely.
Well, what about a question of a pending legislation? Council Member A goes to B and says, what do you think about that bill? Would that be covered by? And then goes to the Council Member C and says the same thing. What do you think about that bill? Would that be a violation of 92.2.5?
With respect to what do you think about the bill, that can be deemed deliberative. And what I would like to point to this court is that there is a definite definition as to what meeting is. A meeting is a convening of a board which a quorum is required in order to make a decision or to deliberate towards a decision. So the question can be, what does this provision mean? Which is not deliberative and it's not making a decision. But if you're asking, what do you think about this bill, whether it's good, bad, or a great thing, that's more into the realm of the deliberative process in decision making. There has to be some leeway. Go ahead, Your Honor.
I want to get back to mootness later, but let's say for a moment we get beyond mootness. It's not so much the plaintiff's position that we're talking about. Isn't it the Office of Information Practices position on what serial meetings are or are not that we're talking about? I mean, the plaintiff's position is no different than that July 12th letter, is it?
Right. The plaintiff's position adopted the OIP's opinion,
aren't
actually.
Aren't we required to give that OIP interpretation quite a bit of deference?
As far as if, in fact, there was a factual situation before the court and the court was deciding on specific facts whether this was a violation of the Sunshine Law, then that deference can be lent. And I could understand that if there was a factual situation before the court and an allegation that the Sunshine Law was violated, then in interpreting whether that is a violation, the opinions of OIP can definitely be taken into consideration and be given deference. The problem with this case, Your Honors, is that the trial court took a situation without any facts, and in fact was in a factual vacuum, and then made an advisory decision in drawing a line at where Serial 101 communications were permitted.
Let me direct your attention to 92-12, you know, where it authorizes any person to file a complaint in circuit court to require compliance with or prevent violations of the Sunshine Law once a prohibited act occurs. Well, if the OIP July 12th letter is correct, a prohibited act occurred, therefore a suit is permissible under the statute.
Proposed to Your Honors that a prohibited act did not occur. In fact, the attempt to reorganize the council was expressly addressed in the court's decision in saying that subsection C of 92-2.5 specifically allows council members to speak about reorganization serially and can trade votes and can address any of these issues without limitation. That particular factual scenario, maybe inadvertently, but nevertheless addressed by the trial court, that situation is specifically covered under subsection C. Therefore, a prohibited act did not occur, and for
that was only the circumstance after the council changed its rule, correct? Prior to that, under their rules, they're required to vote on the reorganization, and their requirement of voting made it official council business, didn't it?
It was official council business nonetheless. It was official council business if they had to vote on it or whether or not they had to discuss on it.
Well, Chair, if I could, you know, a council, it seems to me like you're trying to have it both ways. On one hand, you're saying there was no decision, it's very up in the air. The council really hasn't taken a position. On the other hand, in this litigation, you've quite clearly taken the position that serial communications are acceptable. If you look back in the legislative history of the resolution we were just discussing, the council quite clearly took the position that it disagreed, I think, with the OIP's opinion.
Absolutely. So the individual council members disagreed with OIP's opinion as to a complete bar as to serial communications. There is a range, Your Honor, of impermissible serial communications to a place that it's permissible. The court has recognized this. The court recognized this in saying that procedural matters are okay. Matters that can be subdivided into separate council businesses is okay. There is a validation, in fact, of the city council's position by the court's order in recognizing that there are exceptions to.
But the city council takes the position contrary to OIP's interpretation of that statutory provision, correct?
It's contrary only to the extent if OIP says it's complete bar to serial communications.
All right, so assuming we find this case moot and the city council subsequently, contrary to the OIP's interpretation, engages in serial one-on-one communications, how would the public ever know that that was occurring?
That is a matter of evidence. And if, in fact, the council member says, didn't we talk about this in any evidentiary circumstance?
In other words, the council's view of it is they're doing nothing wrong. So isn't this something that needs to be decided? Otherwise, it's going to evade review.
It has to be based on specific facts, Your Honor. If there was a series of secret meetings or series of confidential meetings that resulted in decision-making or deliberation towards decision-making, that would be a violation of the Sunshine Law. If, in fact, there are no facts to consider, there are certain circumstances where serial communications are perfectly all right. The circuit court said so. The circuit court said so. There are specific circumstances that I can cite to the court as being examples of where serial communications will have to be allowed.
Can I ask you this? You know, again, you're taking a very extreme position in this case, which is that we should declare the controversy moot, say it's over, done, and the litigation is over. The plaintiffs are taking a very broad position and saying all serial communications are prohibited. And in essence, the trial court adopted that approach. Is there an intermediate position that you could suggest to us?
The intermediate position is, if in fact this court is going to allow the trial court to rule on the merits, then the intermediate position would be to set forth any and all exceptions to the prohibition on serial one-on-one communications. For instance, if the individual council members wanted to put something on the agenda and the chairman of the committee wasn't having it on the agenda, the chairman might say, if you got a majority that wants to put it on the agenda, I'll put it on. There has to be an allowance for serial communications to put an agenda item on. Another circumstance is if Councilmember A talks to Councilmember B in year one, and that issue dies. In year eight, the prohibition is that Councilmember A can't talk to Councilmember C about the issue again. 8 years have passed, can't talk about it. What is this provision about? How about a question where Councilmember A goes to Councilmember B and says, what is this about? This bill is about addressing this problem. And then Councilmember C comes in and Councilmember A has to say, I can't talk to you. The whole essence of the Sunshine Law is that it should be open to the public and should promote public participation in government, but it shouldn't be used to cripple effective lawmaking or policymaking. Elected officials must be enabled to perform the people's business, and the Sunshine Law shouldn't unduly restrict public officials in their performance.
How would our adopting the OIP's view of the 92.2.5 affect, as a practical matter, the council's ability to do its business?
The very fact that all of these examples, including those examples in which the trial court accepted when I was putting forth all of these examples in trial court, would be prohibited under the OIP's position because it made no conditions as to when serial one-on-one communications were permissible. And that is the fault of the OIP opinion when it first came out because it was a complete bar. Whether in fact there was procedural...
The council could not operate if we adopt the OIP position?
It could not operate efficiently. It could not operate effectively. This court must allow a legislature. There's a reason why the state exempted itself from the Sunshine Law. This court has to allow a legislative body to do the people's business. Otherwise, that effort in doing the people's business is effectively thwarted if there's a complete bar to communication between council members. The two-person permitted interaction is there for a reason. The rest of the permitted interactions are there for a reason. Where there is no deliberation or decision making, that should not be prohibited. If in fact there is an intermediary position, That position should be that where there is no deliberation or deliberation towards a decision or decision-making in these communications, those kinds of communications should be allowed because
that by definition would be excluded under the statute anyway. Doesn't the statute only apply to decision-making or deliberation?
That's not what OIP says, though. That is the problem. If, in fact, this court recognizes that there are communications that fall without or outside of the definition of meetings because it's not deliberative, it's not decision-making, then very well.
If we make a procedural substantive decision, you're happy with the OIP's interpretation?
If there's a procedural...
In other words, setting the meeting time, talking about when the meeting's going to occur, procedural matters that don't involve the substance of the decision making.
But there are substantive.
Well, answer my question first. Would you be okay with that? Is that the
I would
thing
not be okay
about?
If it's simply procedural as an exception. There has to be substantive discussions, for instance, if there is an inquiry for information gathering. If there has to be some allowance for council members to talk to each other about what a bill means before they go to the meeting. There has to be substantive discussion. Otherwise, there will be complete thwarting of effective lawmaking.
So can council members, and this will be our wrap-up because your time's expired, could council members, for example, have a discussion about your view about the pros and cons of where you might site a new waste landfill in Honolulu? Could not.
If, in fact, there are serial communications that are deliberation or decision-making in nature, then I would concede, Your Honors, that that is prohibited. You can't have a bunch of one-on-one communications which amounts to a meeting of a quorum. I understand that. That is that is expressly, and I will concede that point to the plaintiffs. Decision-making and deliberation is the essence of what council needs. The council can't do in a serial one-on-one communication. But they can do other things like information gathering, setting stuff on the agenda, calling for a special meeting, asking what a provision means. Allow the council to do the people's business. That's all that the city is asking.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Kidoka. Mr. Yip?
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Elijah Yip, and I'm here with co-counsel Jeff Portnoy, and we represent advocacy groups, and I think the name of our first client sums it up, the Right to Know Committee. These groups are interested in open government, and that's the issue in this case. In the Sunshine Law, the legislature declared it the policy of the state that the formation and conduct of public policy shall be conducted as openly as possible. And the legislature understood that open government is the only viable and reasonable method of protecting the public's interests. So clearly, the legislature took pains to elevate the public's right to know to a position of high importance. And yet, the council attempts to undo the handiwork of the legislature with a scheme that's no more sophisticated than the childhood game of telephone. The Circuit Court was correct to rebuff the Council's attempts, and we urge this Court to affirm the Circuit Court's rulings in three respects. First, that it is a violation of HRS-2.5 subsection A for government board members to discuss board business by means of serial one-on-one communications. And second, that the council did not extinguish the main controversy in this case. And third, that plaintiffs do have standing to bring this lawsuit. Now, we are also cross-appealing a portion of the rulings below because although the Circuit Court understood what the main controversy was in this case and even ruled in plaintiffs' favor on that issue, it only awarded plaintiffs 25% of their fees. And the explanation for this anomalous result is that the Circuit Court applied the incorrect analysis to our fee motion. And so that portion, we urge the court, the fee order, we urge the court to reverse.
As far as that last point, did you point out the correct analysis for the circuit court to undergo as far as your fee request?
Yes, we did, Your Honor. Yes, we did. In our reply brief in support of our motion for attorney's fees, we pointed out that a reduction in fees was not permissible, was not appropriate, because there was no discernible method of apportioning fees between the successful claims and the dismissed claims. And that's precisely the Hensley and Schefke analysis that the court should have performed.
Did you argue the level of success prong in the Hensley analysis?
We did not specifically argue insofar as that point of level of success, but I would suggest to the court that the importance is preserving the issue for appeal. And that line of reasoning is just an elaboration of that same argument.
Your position would be you preserve the issue for appeal, but you didn't quite give the guidance that you could have given to the lower court.
I think it would be fair to say that we did not give the nuanced analysis we certainly did on our appellate briefs, but we did preserve the issue on appeal, and it is permissible to elaborate on that particular issue.
The issue really giving the trial judge notice of what you're arguing?
Yes, it is. And I think that.
In this case, did you give the trial court notice that you wanted her to apply the analysis in the cases you're citing on appeal?
I believe we did, because that the analysis of levels of success is part and parcel of apportionability. If the claims, if the ultimate issue in that case was decided in favor of the prevailing party, if it's so intertwined, then you can't separate it, obviously. And the plaintiffs therefore prevailed on the main issue in the appeal. I'm sorry, not in the appeal, in the litigation. And that determines the success. In other words, did the litigants prevail on the main issue in that case? Were they successful? And if they were, and if all the other issues surrounding the lawsuit that were not successful are related to that ultimate issue that the plaintiffs prevailed on, then yes, the level of success analysis should weigh in favor of the plaintiff. And we did alert the court to that particular analysis in our reply brief.
Counsel, as far as your arguments, could we get to mootness first?
Certainly.
Because if we don't get beyond that, we get to nothing else.
Yes.
As far as the city's position on mootness, in a regular civil lawsuit, if you're moving to enjoin an action and the action is no longer there when you file your lawsuit, you don't have a lawsuit. You don't have standing. It's moot. But is the doctrine of mootness different within the confines of the Sunshine Law?
That's an excellent question, because I believe we need to take a step back and look at, I'd hate to use the word standing, because I think it's a slightly different doctrine, but mootness is basically the doctrine of standing over time. Now, if we look at 92-12C, I think that's the provision that maybe throws a wrench in the conventional analysis, because it states that any person may bring an action, and not only any person, but any person may bring an action to prevent a violation. And so if the traditional analysis of standing and mootness were applied, it just doesn't work in the Sunshine Law, because normally you would not be able you would have to show injury. Obviously, if you're trying to prevent injury, the injury hasn't occurred yet. There is no injury. Under traditional analysis, there would be no standing then. But that's not what the Sunshine Law says. 92-12C does allow standing to bring a lawsuit to prevent violations, and that's precisely what we've done here.
Even with that, and understanding that 92-12 colors the analysis, what's your response to the argument that we really are being asked to rule in the abstract, on an abstract question of law, as opposed to one that's grounded in a particular set of facts, as
right.
Courts traditionally do? And that is somewhat striking is, I think, the circuit court realized that there could be unintended consequences when you rule in a very broad fashion, divorced from a particular set of facts. You can reach out and affect situations you might not even anticipate. The circuit court identified two of those situations, procedural issues and the handling of budget bills, But isn't there a concern that there could be countless other ones out there that we could be affecting by affirming this ruling without even realizing it? And that's why courts generally decide cases based on facts rather than abstract issues. What's your response to that?
Certainly, Your Honor, the court is to effectuate the policy of the legislature. It's the legislature's job to dictate what the policy is. And policy, by definition, is not necessarily conforming to certain facts. It's a general rule. And I think in this context of open government, it's unworkable to say that every controversy has to be framed by particular facts, because then every action the council takes, does that get litigated? There has to be a bright line rule. The bright line rule was articulated by the legislature, and the circuit court rightly explained what the confines of that rule is. And I believe actually the trial court's ruling, the court was earlier asking, what is there an intermediate step? And the trial court's ruling is the intermediate step, because it did carve out certain exceptions such as procedural matters, and we don't dispute that. We think that's fine. That does not cripple the council's actions. Regarding the...
Under the statute, how are procedural matters excludable? What in the statute lets you exclude procedural matters?
It would not be deliberative of a matter. It would not be a deliberation toward a matter under the jurisdiction of the council.
Determining what might be on the agenda for a particular meeting, is that procedural or deliberative?
I think that's procedural.
Procedural. So the council members can talk about, well, we'll put on a new landfill next time. That'd be okay. They can have serial discussions about
I believe they would be able to say, can we put that on the agenda and stop there? I don't think they can go on and say, well, what do you think of the proposed amendment or resolution or what have
you? Where in the plain language of the statute does it say that that's okay?
Well, if you look at the... if you look at the definition of a meeting means the convening of a board for which a quorum is required in order to make a decision or to deliberate toward a decision upon a matter over which the board has supervision, control, jurisdiction, or power. In that instance, in putting an item on the agenda is not a deliberation. It's simply putting it. It's ministerial in a sense. So we're fine with that. And the suggestion that if the court does not agree that would cripple government, frankly, is doesn't hold water. And I think...
What about the council's position, the question, what does that proposed legislation mean?
I'm sorry,
Serial communications be conducted with that question asked. What does that... Councilman A, you've introduced this measure. What does that mean? And more than one person goes up to him and asks that question.
I think if the answer... If the purpose of the question was simply to get information, and the answer gives information and not an opinion or does not attempt to solicit a commitment to our vote, that would be permissible under the definition of a meeting.
Same definition of meeting.
Yes, that would be permissible. And we wouldn't go so far as to say you can't even talk to the person about matters like that. And I think the trial court's ruling would be consistent with that. And in fact, getting back to the intermediate position or the intermediate quality of the trial court's ruling, the court recognized that in certain instances, a board could meet in a private setting, but the key is you have to comport with subsections B and C of the statute of 92-2.5.
Well, isn't the point, those are the two things that the court happened to think of, that day, procedural issues, how do you handle a budget bill, but isn't there just, a sort of wealth of different types of decisions the council makes, types of actions, types of discussions that are held, and in essence, we're reaching out, or the circuit court reached out and adopted a blanket rule without being able to evaluate those situations as they come up in particular factual contexts, which, frankly, is the process of the common law.
I actually would just beg to differ a bit in that I don't think the trial court issued a blanket ruling. I think the legislature dictated a policy and a bright line rule.
Right, but you apply the policy to specific facts. I mean, that's kind of the gist of the council member's argument. You should apply it to a specific factual context in a specific case, and then when the next case comes up, you develop it further, and over time, you get the result right because you have the facts in front of you in each case, as opposed to ruling without the facts. Because frankly, in this case, really the fact that this came up, would you agree with me, and the action that the council took is really almost irrelevant. In fact, I think you argue it is irrelevant at this point.
I actually don't think it's completely irrelevant. And I'm glad you brought up that point, because the council makes a big deal about what was left in the complaint. It alleges that only one paragraph was left in the complaint. All the factual allegations were gone. And that's actually not quite accurate, because what the council actually did that was the impetus for this case is quite important. And I'd like to take the opportunity to actually correct a couple of matters on the record. First of all, Resolution 05-243 was a resolution that had to be voted on, as Judge Nakamura pointed out. So it was board business. And not only that, it was not governed by subsection C, because subsection C allows fewer than a quorum of council members to meet in private. And here we had six council members introducing the bill, the resolution, which suggests that that requirement was not met. Those were the two distinguishing points about subsection C.
I have a question on 92.2.5. Can that provision be read to allow serial one-on-one communications on substantive business, as long as the number of members involved in those one-on-one communications falls short of a quorum?
No, I do not believe it can.
Why not?
Because the statute says two members.
Right, but it doesn't say, it's silent on the question of, I think everyone agrees that serial one-on-one communications with enough members to constitute a quorum is no good, because that obviously would violate at least the spirit of the meeting requirement, the open meeting requirement. But my question is, why, what under the statute would say that you can't have serial one-on-one communications with council members as long as the total number of members involved falls short of a quorum?
I think that's where the trial court did find an ambiguity in the statute. And for guidance to that question, the court looked to three principles of statutory construction, which I believe the court should accept here as well. The three principles were, first, that subsections and related sections of a statute should be read in pari materia.
Right, but the other provisions of the statutes can be read as focusing on a quorum requirement, because they all refer, B and C refer to two or more members can meet as long as it's not a quorum.
Correct.
So why can't in pari materia the statute be read to be focusing on a quorum limitation? In other words, you can meet, but you can't meet and discuss official substantive business to the point that more than a quorum of members are involved.
I believe because you run the risk of there still being a consensus building that should be done out in the open. And subsections B and C, perhaps they don't speak directly to that point, and I would grant that. But I would also impress upon the court that there are other principles that the court did rely on, such as the OIP opinion and granting deference to the opinion of the OIP unless it's palpably erroneous.
So isn't that the key, that many of the questions or hypotheticals posed on what exceptions there are to the bar on serial communications, that a letter from OIP in future cases would be valuable? When instances come up, as in this case, that OIP be asked to give its opinion on whether or not it's an exception or whether or not it's covered.
I think the difficulty in that is that the public will not necessarily know if those violations occur. I mean, I would liken the situation here to another childhood analogy, where a mother tells a son, "I've baked cookies for guests. They're on the counter, and." Don't touch them, and lo and behold, the child gets caught with his hands in the cookie jar. What the council is doing here is saying, well, you've only caught me with a chocolate chip cookie, and I promise never to touch chocolate chip cookies again, forgetting that there's also oatmeal cookies and other types of cookies in the cookie jar. The point being, they got caught, and that's enough. When are they going to get caught again? When will the public be alerted to that unless they do get caught again? So relying on that situation to bring these violations to surface and wait for the facts to develop is not workable. What we do have here are facts. We do have facts.
We limit our decision in the framework of that facts. In the framework of those facts, there were serial one-on-one communications with more than a quorum of council members. Should we only decide that issue in this case?
I would concede that that's a fair, that would be a fair framing of the issue. I think those were the facts of this case. I think it is important, though, to note that the resolution was a resolution. It was board business. So it wasn't simply about selection of board officers, which is what the council argues.
Why not just have a declaration that what in fact happened here, which related to the selection of board officers, violated the law?
Because the resolution was about board business, and I think that's important. The key here is not, the way to frame the controversy is not whether serial communications are permissible to deliberate on selection of board officers. That's not the issue. The issue is, under subsection A, is it permissible to engage in serial communications regarding board business? And the position of the council repeatedly has been that's permissible under section A. And I would also note, the reason why this issue needs to be decided and why it's not moot is because the equivocation that the council has demonstrated, even up to the oral argument, it would not commit to a position. Well, the courts need to pronounce what the rule is, so that there would be guidance for future boards, for other boards, and future situations.
Wouldn't a narrower decision provide that guidance? And just as in any other case, or the more typical case, parties would apply the reasoning of that decision to the facts that come up in a future situation, and then if need be, that situation could come back to the court?
I think the facts here are not just the reorganization, it's about board business, and I would analogize it to another situation before the Supreme Court, Johnson versus Ng. That was a case regarding election ballots and the propriety of election ballots. Now, one way to frame the issue in that case could have been the particular error in the ballot, but that's not how the court framed the issue. The court said what we need to decide is whether the circuit court has power to enjoin an election using improper ballots and also just the propriety of ballots in general. So it didn't focus itself, it didn't characterize the issue in a hyper-specific way. It looked at the larger principle at issue, which is can you use improper ballots in an election? And analogously here, can a board use subsection A to discuss board business in a serial fashion? That's the proper way of framing the controversy.
The Office of Information Practices is a very little utility in all of this.
No, I don't believe.
For the court.
No, I don't believe it. I think it fulfills a very vital function because it was the one who caught the council with its hands in the cookie jar. And knowing those facts, then it articulated a position. And we fully agree with that position, and the circuit court did as well, and there's no reason to suggest that the opinion was palpably erroneous. So no, we do suggest that the court affirm the trial court's opinion on that basis as well, on giving deference to the OIP opinion. And, Your Honor, if I may take a moment to turn to the cross-appeal, what the court failed to do in this case was to look at the relationship between the successful claims and the dismissed claims. The order it gave was very terse. It essentially said that I believe that it is divisible between moot and non-moot issues, and so I am awarding only 25% of the fees. There was no clear explanation of how the court came to that conclusion. There was certainly no analysis of the relationship between successful and dismissed claims. And that's clearly required by Schefke.
Was there any request by you for findings of fact, conclusions of law by the lower court and making that determination as far as attorney fees?
No, we did not specifically require that. But I would just suggest to the court that that's a requirement under law, under case law. And so it was a responsibility of the trial court to articulate those findings under Schefke. And I would also note that just the 25%, 75% division is arbitrary. If the court were truly concerned about apportioning the fees, again, the court understood what the main controversy of the case was, and it decided that controversy in favor of the plaintiffs. And yet, it decided that only 25% of the work was done towards that main controversy. That simply doesn't make sense. It doesn't compute. And if there was some reason, then the court should have clearly articulated what that reason is, and it failed to do that. Moreover, the circuit court did not award fees for the moot claims, even though the council deliberately tried to take this controversy out of the courts. It deliberately did that, and there's case law that says when a litigant tries to do that, when a defendant tries to do that.
Did they try to do that before the complaint was filed?
Yes, they did. But
they weren't litigants.
No, at that point they were not a litigant, but the very purpose of their action was to preclude a lawsuit, and again, not on the specific issue of.
Isn't that a good thing?
I'm sorry?
To preclude a lawsuit?
Not if it is, not if the purpose is to prevent the public from getting a definitive ruling saying this is a violation of the open meetings rule. No. And again, the controversy, again, was not the reorganization. It was to, and I would note that the so-called cure was not a cure, because the resolution that effectuated the reorganization was board business, and so the serial communications were a violation of subsection A, and the amendment of the rules did not cure that technical violation. The only reason why they could make the mootness argument is by saying this particular narrow issue of reorganization will never occur again. That's the chocolate chip cookie argument. Now, there are many other cookies in the jar.
We agreed with you on your attorney fee claim. Would we have to remand it for the lower court to do the proper analysis?
No, I don't believe so, Your Honor, because there would be nothing left. There would be no factual determinations for the court left to decide, because the court did determine that the hours expended were reasonable. It found that the fees were reasonable. It just decided to take a portion off the top for a legal reason. And the legal reason, or the failure rather, was that it did not analyze the relationship. If this court decides that pure issue of law, it does not need to remand to the circuit court. We already have a factual finding in place. That much we do have.
We still have to look at whether certain aspects of the fee request, like the discovery matters, but we still have to decide whether that falls within the prevailing party doctrine.
No, because the circuit court wasn't concerned with that. That's not before this court, and the circuit court wasn't concerned with that. It didn't articulate those as reasons for reducing the fee award. The only reason given for reducing the fee award was some claims are moot and some are dismissed. And that legal question is dispositive of the fee issue. Unless the court has any other questions? Thank you.
Your Honors, I don't want to waste time in the little time I have quibbling about attorney's fees, because I believe that the substantive issue is so crucial to the effective management of government that I need to address some of these claims. One of the surprising things that I noticed in their argument is that I agree with some of it. And the part that I agree with is if they're non-deliberative and it's not decision-making, that those serial one-on-one communications are allowed. If it's non-deliberative and doesn't go towards the definition of meeting, those serial one-on-one communications are allowed.
Well, you don't even get to the statute under their reading, because under their reading, it's not a meeting. If it's not a meeting, then the open meeting requirement isn't implicated. So under their meeting, procedural matters are not matters, serial or otherwise, that have to be subject to.
And that's well and good, Your Honor, except that the OIP opinion and the circuit court opinion are not couched in those terms. If, in fact, the exceptions to the prohibition in those two opinions stated that non-deliberative or things that don't qualify as meetings do not fall within the prohibition for 0101 communications, I would have less of a problem with it. So the whole gist of the thing is that if it's non-deliberative and it doesn't go towards a meeting, or as Your Honor pointed out, doesn't amount to a quorum, then those kinds of communications are allowed just under the definition of whether it's a meeting or not.
Quorum on the meeting part of it, but I think that there's an ambiguity in the statute with respect to the serial 101 communications under 92-2.5.
Right, and what I'm saying is was so expertly couched by Chief Judge's questions as to whether you need a factual basis to make that determination. And our position is, of course, there needs to be a factual factual context in which you make a ruling. There are a myriad of examples that I can bring up that can't be anticipated, and there's a myriad of examples that I can't think of as far as examples of when 0101 communications have to be allowed for effective government. Therefore, the court cannot make an issue and make a ruling in a factual vacuum.
Doesn't 9212 sort of seem to invite that? What's your reading of 9212 that would say we shouldn't engage in that kind of inquiry?
As far as preventing a violation, first of all, there has to be a determination of violation. Just the mere fact that there's a disagreement between the parties as to whether a violation occurred.
Let me ask you this. It says, or to determine the applicability of this part to discussions or decisions. Why aren't we, in some sense, determining the applicability of this part to serial one-on-one communication?
Because the court cannot anticipate what discussions are included within
its
ruling.
Although the result of the resolution is moot, can't the factual framework in which this controversy arose provide the factual background from which we can give the structure for our decision? So it's not simply a hypothetical situation. Even though the result's moot, can't we consider the factual background with respect to what the council did in terms of serial 101 meetings in voting on this, or coming to the decision on the resolution? Can't we use that as an analytical framework to apply the statute?
You cannot, Your Honor. And the reason you cannot is because that factual situation fell directly within subsection C, selection of officers, and was in fact specifically addressed by the court in saying that that action is okay. Therefore, this court couldn't use that factual situation to determine whether serial 101 communications under subsection A are allowed, because it wasn't a subsection A case. Therefore, a factual vacuum just renders the ruling untenable, in that there are a myriad, as I said, examples that I could bring up that the court can't anticipate. The court cannot draw a line where there is nothing to provide guidance as to what is the factual context of that line being drawn. It's a line drawn in space, Your Honor.
Council doesn't give much deference to the way OIP draws that line either, do they?
That's not true, Your Honor.
Not in this case.
This particular case, the council was reorganizing. Under OIP's interpretation of the law at the time, there could never be a reorganization. The reason being that the council would never bring it up if there wasn't some understanding that a majority of people wanted to have a reorganization. That would be political death.
Does the council ever seek OIP's advice on whether or not
oftentimes
a serial meeting would be appropriate?
The council oftentimes seeks OIP's opinion, and in fact, there are OIP opinions directly addressing council's inquiries. And in fact, in this particular case, it's not in the record, but I'll just, as an officer of the court, say that council member De La Cruz, as chairman of the council, personally met with Leslie Kondo in this case. But with respect to the differences of interpretation, it's just that the council disagreed that it could not reorganize in a fashion in which serial 101 communications took place. And in this case,
that?
The court validated that position by saying they are allowed under subsection C. Yes, Your Honor.
In fact, I'm looking at the committee report for the second resolution. It said, your committee basically felt the Sunshine Law should be allowed, followed for business affecting the public, but the reorganization of standing committees is an internal matter necessarily requiring private discussion. Is that the position of your clients today, that as to public matters, they would agree serial one-on-one communications aren't okay, but reorganization matters?
Well, that's the problem in seeing what category of matters, because it depends on the facts. Because if the facts are non-deliberative, then they're okay. But if they're non-deliberative, they certainly can be substantive. The fact that it's substantive and it's talking about council business, if it's non-deliberative, they're okay. And from what I understand that plaintiffs were arguing just now, is they agree that if it's non-deliberative, it's okay. Except that the circuit court ruling and the OIP rulings do not address the okay portion of the prohibition, because there's no factual basis in which to say what kinds of serial communications are okay. Therefore, there should never be an attempt even to draw a line in a vacuum, because that line can be so arbitrary and so unrelated to the realities. And in this case, what I'm pleading with this court is to understand that there are realities in effective legislation or effective legislative bodies.
Is there a line? What is the line you say we could draw, other than just saying the plaintiffs are out of luck? Is there a decision in this case that would be limited to the facts of this case and declare that to be a violation?
Well, it's at this point an impossibility to relate it to these facts, because these facts, the actions were validated, were expressly validated by the court. And so if in fact there is a factual situation in the future that comes up, the court is welcome. I would welcome the court to draw a line under specific facts. If in fact there were a series of communications, each and every case that was cited by the plaintiffs in this matter was an analysis of the factual situation in that case. If you go to every one of them, I checked out every one of these cases. The ruling was made based on the facts of the case. There were several meetings in a row. There was a quick, rapid-fire succession of meetings. There were one-on-one communications that were conveyed, and then a consensus was built. If, in fact, a consensus was built, that's illegal. That's against the Sunshine Law. You can't have a consensus of the council on a specific item outside of a public meeting. I understand that. What I'm saying is that one-on-one communications are allowed in certain circumstances, and the court can't draw a bright line without a factual context. We have to have the factual context in order for that decision to be made. And I completely agree with Chief Judge's questions, although they're in the form of questions, that there needs to be a factual...
They were in the form of questions, that's for sure.
There needs to be a factual context. Otherwise, it's shooting bullets in the dark without anticipation of the realities.
I'm going to mention attorney fees just briefly, even though. But how can you say that it was waived when they cited the proper case law below and basically made at least one of the two arguments that Chefki and Hensley...
Well, that whole issue is, if you're going to argue something at the appellate level, shouldn't you argue it at the trial level? Just citing the cases and the propositions upon which they stand, I don't think is enough to say that you gave proper notice to the trial court that this is the issue upon which the trial court needs to rule. I would question whether they're a prevailing party. The trial court expressly ruled that serial one-on-one communications are allowed in certain circumstances, and that's all that the council was saying. They are allowed in certain circumstances. So as far as who prevailed, I say the council prevailed.
Thank you, Mr. Kidoka. Mr. Yip, would you care to respond just on the issue of attorney's fees?
Certainly, Your Honor. Very, very briefly about the attorney's fees, I think it's important to put the litigation in context. Here, OIP found that the council violated the Sunshine Law. But OIP cannot bring an action by itself. It's not authorized to under the statutes. However, the citizens groups are, and so my clients took up that burden on behalf of the public to fight this cause. And now we're being caught in this anomalous situation where the plaintiffs took up the cause, got the results that they wanted, that they were fighting for, and our award is 25%. That type of rule, that type of outcome would chill citizen suits. It goes against the very policy of the citizen suit provision and the fee provision. And this also ties in with the question of, are there facts in this case that frame the controversy? Well, the City Council is saying, we have to have facts, catch us next time. Well, if that happens, perhaps what the council will do is again try to moot it, and then argue again on the attorney's fees motion that the suit really wasn't about the action that got mooted. It was about that. It wasn't about a broader issue that the plaintiffs prevailed on, and try to cut the fees. That simply is an unworkable policy, and it goes against the policy of the citizen suit provision and the fee provision. If the court has nothing further, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Yip. I'd like to thank counsel for your arguments today, and we will be taking this matter under submission.